This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Nabil Biagio, and here's what's coming up.
Ruto takes the reign of power from former boss Uhuru Kenyatta, for whom he served as deputy president for the past 10 years. The incoming president likened his win to that of the country gaining independence from colonizers.
That's Mohamed Yusuf in Nairobi on the inauguration of Kenya's President William Ruto. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. In the United Kingdom, King Charles III visited Northern Ireland today on the latest leg of his tour of the four parts of the United Kingdom. He then travelled to London to be at Buckingham Palace for the arrival of the body of his mother, Queen Elizabeth II, who died last Thursday. The Queen's coffin was flown today from Scotland to London and will lie in state in London's Westminster Hall starting tomorrow. People already are lining up to be able to pay their respects to the Queen tomorrow. While throngs are coming out in Britain to mourn the Queen, some of the most popular social media hashtags across the world and in Africa at the moment include "Abolish the monarchy" and "Not my king." The death of Queen Elizabeth, who reigned over the United Kingdom for 70 years, has sparked an international conversation about the future of monarchies worldwide. Darren Taylor reports.
Many Africans say the passing of the Queen is a powerful symbol of the end of the British Empire. Yet, most of the 21 members of the British Commonwealth on the continent have been flying flags at half-staff in honour of Elizabeth. Kenya, Malawi and Rwanda even declared periods of national mourning. Absolutely ridiculous, says Mametle Sebe, a leader of the General Industries Workers Union of South Africa, which has ties to labour groups in Britain and elsewhere on the continent.
This monarchy cannot represent the interests of the working class people, the same as their parasitic counterparts in Africa, in no way represent the interests of the black working class in Africa.
Sebe says he's not surprised that the African middle classes and political and business leaders are paying homage to the Queen and her successor, King Charles, because, he says, they're part of the same elite as the monarchy.
This is an institution that we oppose in solidarity with the British working class, but also as a protest for the legacy of colonialism, racism, and everything that is wrong that they've spread across the world and they continue to signify and symbolize.
But veteran British royal watcher and author John Simpson told a webinar organized by the Signal Risk Group that the country Charles will rule is a very different place to that of Imperial England.
We just got a new government under Liz Truss. The top four positions in that are all held by people who are not white males. There's a woman prime minister, and there's a black chancellor of the exchequer, there's a black minister of defence, and there's a black minister of foreign affairs. This is extraordinary, and a queen...
South African communications professor and royal expert Ruth Tier Tomaselli points out that the king's son, Prince Harry, married a black woman, American actor Meghan Markle. She says King Charles's statements so far about the dangers of climate change, for example, indicate he's not going to be averse to entering what she calls political arenas. But, adds Tier Tomaselli, his speech after being proclaimed king also showed he's going to follow tradition, which includes overseeing the Commonwealth.
In taking up these responsibilities, I shall strive to follow the inspiring example I have been set in upholding constitutional government and to seek the peace, harmony and prosperity of the peoples of these islands and of the Commonwealth realms and territories throughout the world.
She says it's not unthinkable that Charles could apologise for British colonial abuses at some stage, as the early signs are that he'll be a modern, more transparent king.
It appears that he is very keen on doing a double act, on maintaining tradition but also doing it in a way that makes it current and realistic. So I think that it is going to be different. I think that the two things that we're going to see are continuity and change intertwined with each other.
Tia Tomaselli says the British royals aren't going anywhere soon, and they'll maintain a strong presence in Africa for a long time yet. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
VOA will be following the events in the coming days as Britain mourns Queen Elizabeth. Please check voaafrica.com and voanews.com for all the updates. Kenya is swearing its new president, William Ruto, on Tuesday following a tightly contested election. Numerous African leaders attended the ceremony for Ruto, but his chief election rival, Raila Odinga, stayed away. As Kenya's fifth president, Ruto faces a struggling economy, massive debt, and a record drought that has devastated northern parts of the country. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Mr. President, please repeat after me.
In an elaborate ceremony, William Ruto took the oath of office to be Kenya's fifth president at Moi International Sports Center in Nairobi. Tens of thousands of Kenyans, a host of African leaders, representatives from foreign governments and ambassadors witnessed the inauguration. Ruto takes the reign of power from former boss Uhuru Kenyatta, for whom he served as deputy president for the past 10 years. The incoming president likened his win to that of the country gaining independence from colonizers.
Our special gratitude also goes to millions of Kenyans in the Hustler Movement for tirelessly mobilizing for the campaign and executing a historic revolutionary feat, perhaps as great as the daring exploits of our legendary freedom fighters.
After years of neglect, the incoming government campaigned on what it called a hustler platform to empower the poor. Ruto said in his speech that he will work with Kenyans irrespective of whom they voted for. Ruto said as one of his first initiatives, he will lower the cost of food and announce the reduction of fertilizers from $54 to about $30 per bag. Samuel Nyandemo teaches economics at the University of Nairobi. He says the nation's economic state will make it difficult for the new government to deliver on its promises to the citizens.
He's inheriting an economy which is highly affected by foreign debts, implying that it will be very difficult for him to navigate in terms of trying to sort out the promises he gave in the first 100 days. So he's coming into this economic mess. They did two of them. And the coming out of that economic mess will require a miracle.
By they, Nyandemo means Ruto and his predecessor Kenyatta. Critics of the Kenyatta government accused it of overborrowing and corruption. As deputy president, Ruto fell out with Kenyatta, who supported his rival in last month's election, Raila Odinga. Odinga lost with 6.9 million votes to Ruto's 7.1 million. In an election marked by low turnout, a split election commission, and allegations of fraud by Odinga. In the past few weeks, some members of parliament allied to the Odinga coalition party have crossed into the government, a move that has many worried that the country might not have a strong opposition to check on Ruto's administration. Political commentator Harman Munyora says the country will be headed for trouble if the opposition aligns too closely with the new president.
What might be the only danger that people are seeing, given his current approach of poaching people and so on and so forth? We can quickly turn Kenya into a one-party state, not by law, but by practice, because he's out to get all these people on his side. And Raila is the only opposition voice. So if Raila now chooses to keep quiet, he has had enough. Then we shall be going back to one-party democracy.
Odinga, who challenged his laws unsuccessfully at Kenya's Supreme Court, did not attend Tuesday's swearing-in ceremony. In a previous statement, he said he will continue to work to transform the country into a prosperous democracy where each Kenyan fully belongs. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The Kenyan capital, Nairobi, is in celebratory mode is in celebratory mode this evening after President William Ruto took the oath of office to officially become Kenya's fifth president early in the afternoon. But the new president faces many challenges. For a look at those challenges, VOA's Esther Gitui-Yuard spoke with Joy Mdivo, the executive director of the East Africa Center for Law and Justice in Nairobi.
Well, William Ruto, having been deputy president for the last 10 years, knows well what challenges are facing Kenya. So already issues to do with emancipation of the institutions, he has said that he's going to swear in the six judges who are not sworn in by President Kenyatta by tomorrow. He's going to do this. This evening, he has already signed, he's going to sign an executive order delinking the police service from the office of the president. So he has already embarked on the emancipation of the institutions, because institutions, when they're strengthened, then they're able to do that which they're intended to do by law. But of course, there is the hustler dream. People are asking, when is the hustler fund coming in? When is the cost of living going down? So the expectation from the public is very high. And you could see even from his new standard, the standard, the presidential standard, one of the things that's curious is that it has a little wheelbarrow on it. I think he always wants to remind himself that he came on the promise of raising the lives from the bottom up. So that's why I expect he's going to start his next 100 days in office, I think.
Now, even with a petition at the Supreme Court seeking to nullify his win, he had already intimated that he had no time to waste. He was looking forward to forming the next government. What caliber of men and women are Kenyans likely to see included in his cabinet?
The thing about William Ruto that anybody knows him or is going to tell you is that he's indefatigable. He's the kind of person who is always on the go. He starts early, he works until late, and he works nonstop. So I expect you're going to see a cabinet that is very switched on, very on point. The same energy is sort of like what we saw with the late John Pombe Magufuli, where if you're caught snoozing, you're out. There's no room for neither here nor there. And he's also a person who is keen on results. He looks for the low-hanging fruits. Let's get the things done first that can be done, and then we'll deal with the big things later. So I expect we'll see a lot of change, given how government works. Rather than big major projects that affect a few people, we'll see a lot of initiations of small projects that make quick gains for the Kenyans. So I think that's what we're going to see with the WSR administration the next few days.
You talked about his Hustler Nation mantra. He ran that campaign, of course, with that symbol of a wheelbarrow, signifying the low cadre of, you know, majority of Kenyans who are struggling to make ends meet. What do Kenyans expect him to do first to be able to feed their families? The price of maize meal has been high. It's been unaffordable. What is next for Kenyans?
One of the things that most Kenyans are looking forward to is a direct impact on their cost of living. Now, there are things that are definitely long-term, but like you said, the cost of maize meal being up means ugali, which is the primary staple food for most Kenyans, has become out of reach for most Kenyans. So I expect where there are taxes that can be waived, where there is import duty that can be waived, in the short term to try and bridge this, even edible cooking oil has been very, very expensive of late. Then he had a conversation about lowering the cost of fuel by removing some of the tax levies on it. Now, transport is one of those factors that increases the cost of food. So if you're able to bring down the transport cost, then that affects the price of food. So I expect that you will see initiatives that are aimed at cushioning the lowest cadre of society from the vagaries of what is actually generally an economic downturn, while we see the longer-term strategies being implemented. For example, he has talked about the price of fertilizer. Now, this is going to affect the next harvest. It's not going to help us now. So you put in some short gap measures that he has already indicated, and then bring in a plan that will make sure by the next harvest and the harvest after, the cost of production goes down so that the food is more affordable and so that more people are able to access it with little difficulty or less difficulty anyway.
That was Joy Mdivo, the executive director of the East Africa Center for Law and Justice in Nairobi. She was speaking with Africa 54's Esther Gidui-Yuard earlier today. You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington. A hospital official in Ethiopia's Tigray region says an airstrike Tuesday hit in the capital Mekelle hit a university campus and a TV station, wounding at least one person. News agency Reuters reports the regional government-run Dimitsi Weyen TV station and the business campus of Mekelle University were hit by the strike. A government spokesperson did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The strike comes 2 days after Tigray officials appeared to offer an olive branch to the Ethiopian federal government in stating they would agree to peace negotiations mediated by the African Union. The African Union and many world leaders had welcomed Sunday's announcement by the regional government of Tigray that it is willing to participate in AU-led peace negotiations. Senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Cameron Hudson, says the announcement may have been triggered by a shift in the balance of power on the battlefield, as well as the dire humanitarian situation in the Tigray region.
There's a fighting going on both sides, which we don't have a lot of visibility into. And so I think that there is a portion of this that is driven by either battlefield gains or losses that we're having a hard time, I think, interpreting. But also, I mean, I think we have to remember the strain that the TPLF has been under for many months, even years now, with respect to the humanitarian blockade. And even though there was this tentative ceasefire, there was never a full resumption of humanitarian assistance into the region. And so the TPLF has maintained from the very beginning and even since the resumption of hostilities that its principal objective was not, you know, independence or political autonomy or, you know, anything else. It was the full humanitarian access, and it was the resumption of services inside the region. And so presumably it believes that that engaging once again in peace talks is the best way to achieve that that objective right now.
And the TPLF had objected to the AU mediation before. They favored mediation led by Nairobi. And what has changed now? They're ready to let the AU lead the process.
Well, we don't know what's changed on the battlefield so much, but there is a presumption that there have been some battlefield changes. But I think you've seen, you know, certainly the United States envoy has been on the ground for the past week or more. You haven't seen from him, you know, a lot of public statements, but there's a real sense that the United States and others, the EU, are putting a lot of pressure on both sides behind the scenes, and I think promising to the TPLF, at least, to play a more active role in support of AU mediation. So I think part of the problem that the TPLF saw was that the AU mediation led by President Obasanjo was essentially doing its own thing. It was untethered from other international actors. And I think what we're seeing here is a commitment by the U.S. and others to play a more active and ongoing role in the mediation, part of whether we call it a formal mediation team or kind of an informal support system. I think the TPLF now has greater confidence that Obasanjo will not be acting as a lone actor, as he has been for many months now, but that he will be acting in concert with other powers, frankly, who the TPLF have more confidence in as mediators.
And how do you expect the negotiations to go? And will they finally possibly put an end to this brutal and prolonged war?
Well, there, I think it's premature to say. We can't take a very long-term perspective on this. And certainly, I think the TPLF is not taking a long-term perspective. The fact that they're willing to talk right now suggests that is their short-term need for humanitarian access and services to be restored. That's really driving and motivating it right now. if we can get to a point where there is full humanitarian access, where there is a restoration of banking services, electricity, communications, all of the things that have been shut down, then I think we can begin to talk about, okay, what are the next steps? But until those immediate, really survival needs are met, then it's very difficult to talk about an end to the war or a political settlement, those kinds of things. I think there's a lot more that has to be achieved before that conversation can happen.
That was Cameron Hudson at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. 50 million people were living in modern slavery last year, according to global estimates by the International Labour Organization, the group Walk Free, and the International Organization for Migration. Terry Fitzpatrick, director of the Alliance to End Slavery and Human Trafficking in the U.S., tells VOA's Carol Van Damme the figure means forced labor and forced marriage have increased significantly.
The thing that's important to know in the report is it's everywhere. It's illegal everywhere, but it's happening everywhere, and that's important to know. From reading the report, you can see that the highest total number of people in modern forms of forced labor are in the Asia-Pacific region, but the highest prevalence or percentage of the population in countries where you find yourself having more people in modern forms of slavery are in the Arab state and through the Middle East. So it's a different picture in different parts of the world.
Is that mostly due to cultures and tradition?
I think a lot of it's also due to migration. Now, the number that the report puts on it is about 15% of people who are in forced labor situations today are outside their home country. And so that does mean 85% of forced labor is happening right at home within a country, even within people's own home villages. But I think what you find in a lot of the Middle East countries is people migrate for construction jobs, for service jobs at hotels, to work as domestic workers. And so that changes the dynamic of who is in the country and who might be in situations of forced labor.
Like you just pointed out, the report says most cases of forced labor, 86%, are found in the private sector. How does that happen?
I think one of the most important things to understand here is that this report further highlights the need to light a fire under movement and governments around the world to get going and fund the efforts that are necessary to fight this problem. And it helps dispel some myths. The myth that modern slavery or human trafficking is about brothels and it's about forced commercial sexual exploitation. It is, but it's mostly about people working in forced labor in manufacturing, or in mines, or in domestic workers, or construction, or in agriculture. And that's where the largest percentage of the problem is. 17 million people in private businesses or by private crew leaders or organizations exploiting people in forms of modern slavery or forced labor, and about 4 million more people forced by governments in prison factories or prison camps or relocation or education centers, as some countries euphemistically call them, to work without remuneration and unable to escape.
That's Terry Fitzpatrick, director of the Alliance to End Slavery and Human Trafficking in the U.S. He was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Damme. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And for world news, go to voanews.com. On behalf of producer Nadia Taha and engineer Nick Ivanov, thank you for tuning in and for choosing The Voice of America.
Leaders gather in New York for the annual United Nations General Assembly. Count on VOA to be there, delivering news you can trust on radio, TV, and the web. A free press is essential. VOA Africa, your trusted source for news.